Welcome to another episode of Fuken Conversation. I'm so excited today to have Jennifer Tupper, who's the current dean at the Faculty of Education at the University of Alberta, with us. But she's so much more in terms of her scholarship, and I'm a huge fan, been a huge fan for quite a while, and I think her work is groundbreaking in terms of provoking us to think about the privileges that we have due to settler colonialism here in Canada, and how we can think through those in relation to the work that we do in faculties of education, but also out in the schools. So welcome, Jennifer.
Yeah, thanks, Nick, and thanks for having me. I've been looking forward to this conversation.
Me too. You know, we're here in Ontario, and I know you're in Alberta, and prior to that, you were dean at the University of Regina. And I'm just wondering if you could... I'm just wondering how things are in Alberta. We're seeing a lot on the news in terms of the impact of the 2020 pandemic in relation to what's taking place in the oil and gas industry. Prior to that, we've seen on the media, you know, the financial recession in the province of Alberta and the impacts that that's had specifically with for you in terms of higher education, and then most recently, the flood in Fort McMurray. So I'm just wondering how, you know, so much in terms of dealing with 2020 pandemic, but it seems to me there's so much more going on in your province as well.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. And I'll speak a little bit about some of the things that happened prior to the pandemic and how those challenges have been amplified by our current health crisis. In Alberta, almost exactly a year ago, we had a change in government. The New Democratic Party, who made up government under the leadership of Rachel Notley, was defeated by the United Conservative Party, which was a coalition really of the Wild Rose Party and the Progressive Conservative Party. I would say more of the Wild Rose base makes up the current UCP party. They were elected on a platform of job creation and balancing the budget. Albertans seem to get very, very nervous when they perceive there's too much government spending. They don't like the idea of big deficit or big provincial debt. I think this comes out of, you know, the Klein years especially. And so what we saw happen was two budgets, provincial budgets, drop, one in October, and most recently in February, before we went into lockdown around the pandemic. Both of those budgets would be considered austerity budgets, and particularly challenging for K-12, for our health sector, and for the post-secondary sector especially. The government has messaged that they feel post-secondary in the province of Alberta has benefited from too much funding, that post-secondary has a spending problem, and that needs to be reined in. The way that they've dealt with cuts to post-secondary has been differential, and so it depends on the institution, the extent to which a cut has been realized. So in October, 6 months into the fiscal year, the University of Alberta experienced an in-year cut of 7% to our Campus Alberta grant portion. And then the end of February, we were cut another 11%. So within 6 months, we saw a $110 million reduction to our operating budget, which is probably the most significant reduction the U of A has ever faced, and has created obviously some real challenges in terms of managing those cuts and having to make decisions sometimes quite quickly without necessarily having the capacity to take the time and give careful thought to process and long-term implications. So U of A has been the most adversely affected by the cuts, but I want to be clear that all post-secondary has been adversely affected, and K-12 as well. And this is a real worry for us in the Faculty of Education when we see resources that really are critical to the work that happens in K-12 being pulled away, making it more challenging for school divisions to provide the kinds of supports that they need in classrooms that are more and more complex, not less and less complex. And at the same time, this government decided to pick a fight with doctors and ripped up the contract agreement between the province and the doctors, basically before the pandemic started, and really changed the fee structure and the payment to doctors, and also signaled that there would be mass layoffs, you know, of nurses as well in the province. They backpedaled on that a little bit during the pandemic in terms of the layoff of nurses, but they have held firm on changing physician compensation. So what we're seeing now in the province that you might not be aware of in Ontario is that particularly in rural hospitals where GPs have hospital privileges, we have large groups of doctors saying that they will no longer work in rural hospitals because of the compensation package, which makes it very, very difficult for them to do that work. So we have this kind of crisis happening on multiple fronts. We're in a pandemic, which is a health crisis. We were in an economic crisis prior to the pandemic, which now we've seen escalate as a result of the decline in the economy. I've never seen oil and gas prices so low in my life. And the budget, just as an aside, the budget that came down the end of February anticipated $58 for a barrel of oil. And we actually were into negative numbers a few weeks ago in the province. So we can't even anticipate in Alberta what it's all going to look like on the other side of COVID, except to say that the government continues to be very, very committed to austerity measures. And at the same time, they're implementing a performance framework for funding for post-secondary with a series of targets that we'll have to meet. And there are longer term budget implications as well. So it's kind of been I said the other day, it's kind of been not only a perfect storm, but it's a tsunami size storm. And then of course, with the flooding in Fort McMurray this week, and that's a community that's already been devastated by the economic crisis and the situation with oil and gas. And now we've got 1,200 homes that have been destroyed from the floods and businesses that have been destroyed. And so it's compounding everything. And we're anticipating, in addition, that there'll be an education crisis on the other side of this, as well as the ability for school divisions to continue to support K-12 students during the pandemic through remote learning is very differential depending on the resources of the school divisions and where they are located. And we're hearing anecdotally that in some places in the province, school has just stopped. And so we're going to see this huge gap in terms of where students are at when they come back to schools after the pandemic. So that's kind of our landscape here. I wish I could paint a more optimistic picture, but there you
have
it.
When I listen to that, the lived experiences that you're sharing for you and other citizens in the province of Alberta, I just think about, you know, it's just been recent that you made the transition from University of Regina to the University of Alberta. I imagine this was not the context that you thought you would be transitioning toward in terms of being an educational leader. And so I'm wondering, as an educational leader, how are you coping and working your way through the current crises in the province of Alberta?
Yeah, that's a great question. And to be sure, it's not what I anticipated I would be walking into when I left Saskatchewan in 2017 and came to the U of A. I was so excited about all of the possibilities that existed as an educational leader, both at the U of A and in the province. And I continue to be excited about those possibilities. I want to be clear that I think the work that happens in our faculty and the work that happens in education in this province is amazing work. It's innovative. It is advancing critical conversations about education. But it is always against the backdrop of these real budget challenges, which do require that we think differently about what we do and how we do it. And so in our faculty, you know, we're trying to have a very principled approach to how we manage our budget situation. But the reality is, Nick, that we're going to have to do less with less. And so then how do you make good decisions about the things that are priorities that we know have an impact on the future of education, both post-secondary and also our work and our intersections with K-12. in the province and beyond, and the kind of research that we're able to do when our resources are continually shrinking. And so I'm really proud of the Faculty of Education at the U of A, amazing research that has international reach that makes a difference in the lives of people in various communities every day in real ways. And my worry is that our budget situation will constrain what we're able to do in terms of really impactful and transformative work. And I think sometimes people just get overwhelmed with everything that is coming at them, and that can be very debilitating as well. So what I'm trying to do as an educational leader is still find the positive in all of this, to create opportunities for conversations about how we can be innovative and creative in the midst of constraint. And I think that sometimes actually crisis situations become important opportunities to innovate and to think flexibly. Sometimes when things are going well, we're just kind of going on day by day as we always do. We're not necessarily needing to be so creative. We're not necessarily needing to come together as a community in the same way to have these difficult conversations, but to continue to advance what we believe to be transformative work in our faculty, in our institution, and on behalf of K-12 and other educational organizations. So in some ways, while this is probably the most challenging situation I've ever experienced as an educational leader, I also do see it as one filled with incredible possibilities. And really, we're only limited by our imaginations in lots of ways. Of course, my faculty would always say, and there are budget limitations, Jennifer, and that's true too. But I think it does give us sometimes that catalyst or that push that we need to do things differently, to think about things in different ways. So it's would I like to have a better budget situation, a government that's supportive of post-sec? You bet I would. But I think at the same time, there are ways that we will be able to work through this and do really interesting work as a result of the situation.
And much of your research has looked at the concept of treaty relations and treaty education, really questioning the settler colonialism and those of us who self-identify as being settler Canadians, the privileges we occupy in relation to the negation of treaty relations and treaty education and its present absence from the curriculum. You know, here in Ontario, it's not as prevalent as it is in the work that you did in Saskatchewan in terms of Treaty 4 and Treaty 6. And I'm just wondering how, in light of the current context in Alberta and the pandemic, how are you thinking through your research on treaty relations and in relation to treaty education?
Yeah, thanks for that question. That's a great question, and it's been front of mind for me through all of this. And for me, the crisis actually reinforces my commitment and the work that I think we all need to do to create a treaty ethic for education. And that can happen regardless of what budget crisis we might be in. And in fact, as I said previously, it could be a catalyst for us to think and do differently in education. I think that the economic crisis and the health crisis has surfaced really important conversations about our relationships in this province with Indigenous peoples. And again, this is about how different communities are positioned as a result of these particular crises, who is able to be less impacted, who is going to be more impacted, and what does that mean for us and our commitments to treaties and the treaty relationship. I heard someone speak last week about the experiences of many Canadians and indeed citizens around the world with respect to COVID and the all of the restrictions that we find ourselves living in and the need to self-isolate and the grief that we are experiencing around a dramatic shift in our way of being and our way of doing. And I think that there are parallels to be made that are actually very much part of what colonialism has been and continues to be for Indigenous peoples and our relationship with them. That the losses that we're experiencing right now in this moment in time over the last few months are losses that Indigenous communities have experienced for more than seven generations since really settler colonialism began as a project in this country. And I think it's probably important for us to think about our grief in relation to sense of loss and in the context of relationships with Indigenous peoples. My biggest worry is that the crisis, the multiple crises that we're experiencing right now, will mean that the commitments that were made previously to truth and reconciliation in the province, and these are resource commitments as well, will disappear. And so this becomes critical then for us in education who are committed to this work to continue to lift up and advance those conversations and make them even more present against the landscape of pandemic and economic crisis. And I think a treaty ethic for education can help us engage differently in the teaching and learning that we do in K-12 and the teaching and learning that we do in post-sec. It is relational, and we are all craving relationships in a different way. At least I feel like we're all craving relationships in a different way than what we're able to experience right now. Drawing on the work of Dwayne Donald, who I admire so much and I'm so grateful to work alongside as a faculty member in education, he talks about ethical relationality as critical to any consideration of truth and reconciliation. And so what does it mean to engage in ethical relation against the backdrop of a pandemic and an economic crisis? And how can we bring that into the foreground in our work as teacher educators, as classroom teachers, as educational leaders? So I see this as an important opportunity that we just can't afford to miss.
Part of your work in terms of looking at how we can take up or begin to address our commitment to ethical relations or facilitating or creating or sustaining ethical relations with different Indigenous communities or families or individuals is by taking a look at what constitutes a settler imaginary, and you take that up in your work, and also the concept of settler historical consciousness, and as you state, how it normalizes and celebrates the settler experience, rendering the past and present experiences of Indigenous people either invisible or as distinctly separate from what is worth knowing. And I'm just wondering how, I know you do that work with teacher candidates and teachers out in the schools, but I'm just wondering how you came to that work. And I know your grandfather was a professor, and I'm not sure if you've given any thought to how much, is there a relationship between his work and his lived experiences in higher ed in relation to your family history and the kind of work that you've been doing in your research in terms of calling upon us to challenge, and yourself in many ways, to challenge a settler imaginary in relation to this wider settler historical consciousness.
Yeah, thanks. So I'll talk a little bit about how I came to the work, and it wasn't, it's been a very long journey, and it's a journey that I continue on. I think that there are still many, many opportunities for me to learn from and with Indigenous people in this territory and in other territories. You know, my consciousness truly was a settler consciousness growing up, and I write about it in the book chapter in the edited collection that you and Christina facilitated. And thank you for that, Nick, because that's a great collection of work. So it is about how we are invited to think about and engage in the world through a particular lens. And my lens growing up was that settler lens. And it partly was re-inscribed through family stories, family narratives, family experiences. Yeah, my grandfather was a professor of economics at the University of Saskatchewan in Treaty 6 and made his academic career on scholarship and research focused on the prairie agrarian economy. with no recognition of how we were able on the prairies to establish that agrarian economy in the first place. And that is, of course, through treaties and the treaty relationship that allowed for the settler colonial state to insert itself in Saskatchewan and other provinces where agriculture is so important. So there was an absolute absence, the rendering of Indigenous peoples as, you know, non-existent, literally non-existent. And that was reinforced by my own schooling experience and the other kinds of narratives that my family had about their own past and present and their future imaginary as well. I would say probably it wasn't disrupted for me until I was in university, and even as an undergrad, hardly disrupted at all, because the courses and the experiences that I had there really were reinforcing that settler colonial imaginary and reinforcing my own settler historical consciousness. The disruption didn't happen until really, truly, I was in Saskatchewan at the University of Regina in Treaty 4 with very strong Indigenous presence in those spaces. And it was through those relationships that I began to see the limits of my own knowledge and began to recognize the way in which my own both historical thinking and my historical consciousness had been constructed within that frame of settler colonialism. I think that in schooling, we need to create opportunities for teacher candidates, for in-service teachers, and for young people to really think about their own narratives and create opportunities for them to both understand that settler colonial narrative. And I think that can happen in a variety of different ways and is happening to some extent already in schools. But it's more than just understanding the narrative. It's understanding how we're implicated in the narrative and how we came to think the way that we think and know the way we know. And what is it that we even believe as white settlers in this territory? And then how can we, as a result of that self-reflexivity and that the shifting of our historical consciousness, be more ready to enter into ethical relationships with Indigenous people and live up to and into that treaty ethic that I talked about earlier. In education, it is creating those points of entry. And in Alberta, so you referenced treaty education in Saskatchewan, that's been in place for a long time as a curriculum mandate. I would say Saskatchewan probably further ahead, but just because there's a curricular mandate doesn't mean that it's taken up the way that we might hope it would be and we need it to be taken up across the sector. Although I think the conversations are different now than they were 10 years ago. In Alberta, the new teacher quality standards include competency number 5, which is very much an opportunity for in-service and pre-service teachers to really think about the colonial narrative. So competency number 5 is understanding Indigenous, it's Indigenous foundational knowledge and understanding Indigenous perspectives, experiences, histories, the contemporary relationships with Indigenous people, etc. So now this is part of an expectation that exists for all teachers in the province, that they will have at the very least some base level knowledge. And I think from my own experiences, it's that base level knowledge then that becomes a catalyst for us to really start reflecting and becoming more reflexive on the narratives that we've reproduced as settler teachers as well.
You share in the chapter about the buffalo head in at your cottage, and I don't know if I'm saying this right. Waka. I really appreciated that the way in which you delve into your life writing and your life history to take us back to the way you were thinking at that time, and it, you know, it provoked me to think about our family. We came over in 75 and then eventually made our way up to Kapuskasing, where my dad opened a medical practice in a small rural town. And so I can empathize with the doctors you made reference to in rural Alberta. And in many ways, my father had to stop delivering babies because of the amount of that it cost in relation to insurance to be able to do so. And I think eventually, well, not I don't think, but eventually women who had to deliver their babies had to either go to Timmins or elsewhere and couldn't do it any longer in Kapuskasing. And we had a cottage too at Saconash, and I never ever questioned when growing up, you know, whose territories were we on, and what were the implications for purchasing land. And your work has really helped me to think through that. But more importantly, my sons now, I have three of them, and we married into a family who's been here, like your family, for several generations. And in fact, their great-great-grandfather, Robert Milne Crowell, had purchased land out in, not purchased land, but was given appropriated land as part of the Homestead Act in Yorkton, Saskatchewan. So I'm trying to make sense of that history, and your work lends itself to a wider context and how we might think through that in relation to questioning our own settler colonial history and the kind of privileges that we have. And in many ways speaks to the inequities over time in terms of a financial literacy and the Indian Act and reserve system, and how my three sons on the one side of the family were able to build equity, financial and economic equity, over time because of the appropriation of land in relation to these treaties. So it's something that I'm trying to think through more. In terms of that, but you know, you made reference to the curriculum in Saskatchewan, and in terms of it being really ahead of other places in addressing treaty education in the curriculum, but not necessarily being taken up the way in which you might hope for. And I'm just wondering if you could speak a little bit more to the ways in which you've tried to address that in the research that you've done with teacher candidates in your work. And what and you know, some of the things that you've seen emerge in relation to that work, in terms of some of the blind spots still that we might all have, and then also some of the possibilities.
Yeah, thanks. Great questions. And so I'll try to hit on each of them, but if I've forgotten to respond to one of them, then you'll just have to ask me again. So actually, it was shortly after I arrived at the University of Regina, so 2004 I arrived there, 2005 I was invited to be part of a research project. This was before the curricular mandate for treaty education, but it was at a time when the Office of the Treaty Commissioner in Saskatchewan had done an incredible amount of work to create resources for classroom teachers in the province to use to advance teaching treaties in the classroom. And so there was a kit, the treaty kit we call it, teaching treaties in the classroom. And so the research project I was asked to join, because I was a social studies person and I guess was seen to be, you know, there was relevance between social studies and treaty education, obviously, was to look at the ways that classroom teachers were using that that kit, the teaching treaties in the classroom kit, and what the effects of the learning was on students, both so what they knew before and what they knew after the teaching. So it was a really interesting study, and Mike Capello was the lead researcher on that, and he and I have gone on to do a lot of collaborations and thinking and working together around these topics and issues. But the teachers that were involved in the study were mostly white settler teachers. We had two Indigenous teachers who brought a very different perspective and a different lens and a different comfort with and ease of integrating the treaty kit into their classroom teaching. The white settler teachers that we worked with began in a very, very tentative way, because they felt the inadequacy of their own knowledge and understanding. And some of the other resistances, and I'm going to call them resistances because I think that's what they are, whether teachers are aware that they're resisting or not. I think there are different forms of resistance. I referred to it previously too as sort of ignorance as an epistemological stance with respect to treaties. And I think it's this idea that the work is more meaningful for Indigenous learners. It's less important for learners in non-Indigenous, for settler learners, that it is appropriate really only for social studies classes, etc. So that was, you know, 15 years ago, a lot of those kinds of resistances were being offered up, including by the teachers in our study, who were obviously willing to participate with us, but still had their own concerns. A lot of worry about making mistakes and using that then as an excuse to not make an effort or to take risks. And whereas, you know, elders have said to me, well, it's better to try and make mistakes and then own those mistakes and move through them in a learning way than to not do anything at all because you're worried about making those mistakes. So those kinds of narratives, you know, I don't have Indigenous kids in my classroom. This work isn't relevant to my context. I'm afraid of making mistakes. I shouldn't be the one to teach Indigenous culture. So it's also helping classroom teachers recognize that this isn't about teaching Indigenous culture. This is about bringing to the foreground settler colonialism and how it came to be and what the significance of treaties and the treaty relationship are historically and in a contemporary context. So I found that when you create invitations for teachers to come together and think about this work and be able to express their worries and their concerns and their trepidations, but still require that they do something with the knowledge, that they bring it back into their classroom, I think that's where I've seen shifts over the last 15 years. And teacher education is really critical to this because we have opportunities in faculties of education to work with our students over, I know in Ontario it's 2 years, in Alberta most of our programs are 4-year programs, so we have 4 years to work with our students to develop a stronger foundational knowledge and to support them in thinking about how they integrate what they've learned into classrooms pedagogically, through content knowledge, through place-based learning opportunities, etc. I would say that there have been shifts in terms of the conversations that I'm able to have with both in-service and pre-service teachers over the last 15 years, and especially since the Truth and Reconciliation Commission report and the calls to action and those calls to action specific to education. There's been a lot of work, as you know, nationally. Charlene Bearhead is a leader in this work. The Project of Heart work that Sylvia undertook as well has helped a lot of communities and a lot of educational communities to take up and think about this, sometimes in just very preliminary or beginning ways, but it's a beginning place nonetheless.
In your recent study that you did, I say recent, and the study that you did in 2017, you have a section on encountering our own privilege, and in it you say, you know, part of our growing awareness and understanding of colonialism and the structuring forces of whiteness included considerations of our own privileges as white settler educators who have the luxury of engaging in anti-colonial teaching as much or as little as desired, and who also have the luxury of stepping away from the work when we're feeling saddened, frustrated, or exhausted by it. And I mean, that really resonated with me in terms of, I mean, it's so true even for myself that I might engage these different issues or try to challenge them when I'm at work. But if I come home, maybe I'm not always thinking about them. And that's a privilege in terms of our lived experiences as settler Canadians, my family here in Ottawa, and trying to convey that to students, the teacher candidates that you're working with. So I'm just wondering how you're thinking about that, whether that's in your research or as a teacher educator, even now as dean, as an educational leader.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that all the time. And I would say that that's true broadly also for, you know, anti-oppressive work, that those of us who occupy these very privileged identity positions, subject positions, can have an ease in which we can move in and out of the work. And whereas our racialized colleagues, our minoritized colleagues, Indigenous colleagues don't get to do that. They are always in the work in real ways. And so this is about accountability for recognizing the privileges that we have as white settler educators. And I guess, you know, it's It's so complex, Nick, because, and this is where I experience the tension. It kind of, I'm always drawn back to Aoki's idea of this in-between space, the space of tension, which can be a really challenging space, but it can also be a space of really important and productive possibility. And so I think that we have to recognize that we are going to live in this tension as white settler educators who can move in and out of anti-colonial work, but to keep that front of mind and then to begin to interrogate why it is that we are moving out of it at particular moments in time and what we might need to do to stay in it more fully for more sustained periods of time as well. And it is, I think I've been thinking a lot about, you know, difficult knowledge and resistance to difficult knowledge. And this is partly coming back to settler historical consciousness, because this has been so much a part of how we have understood ourselves, how we have thought about the world, that to completely shift our historical consciousness can be very, very destabilizing for people for all sorts of reasons. So sometimes it's incremental, but I think we have to really interrogate those moments when we choose to move out of the work, and what is it that has compelled us in that moment to not do the work in the ways that we are ideologically committed to and yet can't seem to follow through on. And I do think it is the structuring forces of coloniality that continue to be ever present in our lives. And I mean, I don't know about your family, but my family has not given up our land at Waka Lake. We've not given it back to the First Nations community that really it should belong to. I know belonging is a bit of a funny word, but and that's a constant tension for me when we're at the lake, at the cottage, recognizing that I'm on land that was, that our place, our summer place exists because of the colonialism and the failure to live up to the spirit and intent of treaties and the treaty relationship. And I don't know how to reconcile that, Nick. So if you've got insight, I would welcome it.
I don't know. And that's a question that I keep asking in relation to the elders that I get a chance to work with, or educational leaders that work in Kitigan-Zibi, for example. And my father, we still have the hunting cabin on Saginaw Lake. And an interesting side story to the name, but I think it's important. I did a lot of work with Bertha Commando when she was alive, and she was an elder in Kitigan-Zibi. And one time I shared the story of our lake, and I said, what does Saginaw mean? I've never really asked this. This is me in my 30s asking Bertha, and she's like, Nick, she's like, Saginaw is the, she started laughing. It's a kind of a derogatory word that we would use for white people. And so when the government would come see us as elders, we whispered each other Saginaw, but she said it, but it also means people of the midst. Like, so the first people coming off the boat in the midst. And I've since shared that name with different people, and there's a whole other different interpretations of it. So it's just the irony of growing up on a lake, which means people of the midst, and trying to reconcile that in one's lifetime, if that's possible. And I guess that leads me to ask, how are you thinking then in terms of the work that you've done? Because like if we read your work, and I've read a lot more than the three pieces that you've sent, and kind of looking at the your intellectual journey in terms of the work you've done with Mike Capello, which is amazing, and he's an amazing scholar at University of Regina as well, in terms of the work he's doing and how that's transitioned. I'm curious to know, you know, you've have these publications, and one of them that you sent to me prior to the TRC and the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and its final report and the release in June 2015. And so we're 5 years past and we're 2020. And I don't want to put the TRC in the final report as kind of like the marker of, you know, the nexus of reconciliation, because that's so problematic. I mean, that work has been taking place way before 2015, and it continues to be addressed in terms of all its complexity since then. But in terms of your own research, how have things kind of shifted or stayed the same or changed since that earlier work that you've done? And now, in light of living in Alberta and thinking back, are there, you know, are there things that you're thinking about differently in relation to that earlier work that you're now doing in your current work when you have the time to think and write?
Yeah, when I have the time to think and write, which seems to be less and less these days. Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And I'm struggling a little bit to find the right words to answer it. I think that for me, where my thinking and my work has really shifted is it's come as a result of a much more deeper engagement with what constitutes settler colonialism. So in one of the pieces, the early pieces that Mike and I wrote, the 2008 article, Teaching Treaties as Unusual Narratives, Disrupting the Curricular Common Sense, we did talk about curriculum as a Eurocentric framework, but we didn't really bring in thinking about settler colonialism as a structuring force. And I think that was a miss, but we weren't yet at that point in our own thinking. And so when I am doing my work now, and as you will know from the book chapter in your edited collection, I'm thinking about it in the context of settler historical consciousness. And I think that's the biggest shift. So it's not enough to have content knowledge. It's not enough to be in good relations with Indigenous peoples or to be learning from and with Indigenous peoples. It's also the reflexivity, the capacity to really think about how my own historical consciousness has been structured, how I both reproduce settler historical consciousness as an educator, as a parent, because I have two daughters as well, but how I can work to disrupt settler historical consciousness, or at least ask people to consider it as a construct in the first place. So I would say that's been one of the biggest shifts. And I do think that in order to get to that point, we have to invite people in schools and out of schools to think about how they came to know as settlers and what the TRC might tell us about that knowing and how we can begin to shift our thinking. I think it's necessary if reconciliation is ever going to be more than an aspiration. I don't think we're going to see any real living up to and into treaties and the treaty relationship unless there's a shift in settler historical consciousness. So I guess that would be some of the most significant shifts in my thinking. And I've really benefited from the scholarship of Indigenous colleagues. You know, Marie Batiste has written quite a lot about cognitive imperialism, and I think that's absolutely part of our thinking about what constitutes settler historical consciousness and how it's formed in the first place. And you know, Duane's work, of course, it has been so impactful in my thinking since those earlier research projects and the earlier writing. And now thinking about settler historical consciousness in the context of citizenship and what might it mean for citizenship education to bring in deep understandings of settler colonialism and settler historical consciousness as we consider the way that our political and economic structures operate in particular kinds of ways to reproduce knowing and to continue to undermine the spirit and intent of treaties and the treaty relationship.
I really see the latest piece, and I'm sure you're working on others, but I'm talking about the piece that you contributed to our collection, which is, I have to say, is beautifully written and storied, and you have an act for storing, and the title of the piece, Restoring, is in it a different kind of history that we could take up in relation to treaty education, treaty relations, and settler colonialism. And in many ways, a social studies project, if you afford me an opportunity to call that a social studies project, going back to your roots. And I know my three sons, each of them have been asked to write biographies. They've chosen biographies outside their family. And yours is a rich social studies project in terms of looking at your family history and its interconnections to settler colonialism and settler historical consciousness. And wondering what your approach is to life writing. And you make reference to the life writing project and the scholars affiliated with, whether that's Dwayne Donald or Cynthia Chambers or Erica Hasbey-Lutt. And so what two parts to this question. The first is, what are your approaches to life writing and the strategies you take on in terms of doing that? And if you do take it up with students, how do you take it up with students?
So there were two part question. One was my own process for life writing, the life writing work, and then working with students to do that work. I was going to actually start with the students, but I think I'll flip it and start with my own process. So this is something that I'm always thinking about in the context of my research, scholarship, I would say even my administrative and leadership work as well. And it's really taking the time to sit with particular life experiences and think about how I have storied those, and then how might I restory those against the backdrop of what I know about settler colonialism, ethical relationality, settler historical consciousness. So for me, it's a deeply iterative process, Nick, because I'll write a memory, an experience, a particular narrative, and then it's the layering on of all of those pieces until I can start to make a different kind of sense of that landscape, of how that narrative came to be formed. And I would say that I'm still working on that process, refining that process. Certainly don't have nearly so much time as I would like to for that kind of deep thinking, but Mike and I, we're working on a SHRC project together right now. So we're doing what we're calling some gut work around it. And it is even in the context of that research, how we are taking up and interpreting some of the narratives that have been shared by classroom teachers, Indigenous advocates, students in schools around engagement with Indigenous knowledges, content, and experiences. So I'm trying to be really intentional about bringing that life writing into much of the work that I'm doing. With respect to the work with students, that's a little bit more challenging for me right now because I'm a step removed from teaching undergraduate classes. My role as dean doesn't necessarily allow for that. But I do try to take advantage of opportunities when they present themselves. And so I'll give an example. One of the local high schools here in Edmonton has made a commitment this year to, as a school community and with their catchment schools, so the junior high schools that feed into that high school, to engage with truth and reconciliation education. And of course, they're thinking about that work in the context of teacher quality standard number 5 in the province. And the need for teachers to be able to demonstrate that they are competent, at least a base level competence in those areas. So I've been asked to come and speak and do workshops with classroom teachers. And one of the things that I'm asking for my participants to do is to articulate a narrative of themselves in this space, and working with them to interrogate that through a settler, through an anti-colonial lens. And so what does this story say about this place and our relationship with and to the Indigenous peoples that live in this space? And it's for many, it's a very beginning, but it is, I think, important to ground it in individuals' lived experiences and the stories that they know and are able to tell. And then in a sometimes more gentle kind of way, disrupt those stories and invite them into their own process of writing, reflecting in a recursive kind of way.
So just before we end here, I'm going to ask one more question. So I'm curious, not to think, but call it to think about other things. And but just in terms of research and your scholarship. But I'm wondering, you know, and the same thing could be said for reading. But I'm wondering, who are you reading these days and why? To put you on the spot.
Yeah, who am I reading these days and why? Well, I'm rereading some of Marie Batiste's work because she's got a lot to say about cognitive imperialism, which I think is really critical. And in rereading her work, she took me back to a book that I'd read actually when I was writing my doctoral dissertation, which had quite a different focus, although it was still a critical focus. And that's Elizabeth Minnick's Transforming Knowledge. And it's a really deep dive into how knowledge is constructed, how it shapes our thinking. And I think this is absolutely related to the settler colonial project and the ways in which colonialism continues to insert itself in all aspects of our socio-political material world, etc. So those would be two things. I'm sitting in my den, so I'm looking at my bookshelf as well. And I mean, obviously, I am working my way through the edited collection that you and Christina put together, and really appreciating that that collection as it challenges my own thinking, and the work that you've done, Nick, for sure. And then I would say that I've read, and this is not an academic text, but I think it's a really important text as well, is Jesse Thistle's book. And he is a doctoral candidate at York University, and From the Ashes. And I think it is it's his story of being an Indigenous person in this context of racism and colonialism, and having to negotiate his way in the world as a result of those experiences of colonialism and racism, and the ongoing legacies really of residential schooling. So I do try to read those memoirs that are written by Indigenous people. Lee Maracle's My Conversation with Canadians, I think, is one I keep coming back to. It's pretty hard-hitting. It's kind of gut-punching, and I think that's a good thing to be unsettled in our reading and in our thinking. She doesn't suffer fools, that's for sure, and she really challenges settler colonialism and white settlers to really think deeply about relationships with Indigenous people. So that's another one that's on my bed table. Yeah.
I had an opportunity before the measures for the pandemic were put in place at the University of Ottawa to go and listen to Jesse Thistle present on his dissertation work, and really tracing his life writing through his grandparents and the intergenerational impacts of settler colonialism in relation to the impacts for his grandparents and then for him. And it was an amazing and powerful presentation and reminder of there's so much more work for us to do. I just want to thank you so much for joining us today. Mm-hmm. And really, like I said at the start, I'm a huge fan of your work, and really thinking and really thinking in our thoughts in terms of our family and what's going on in Alberta, and how all of you are trying to negotiate your way through not only the pandemic, but also the financial implications of the oil and gas industry and the flood in Fort McMurray. And hope, you know, you can come back in a few months and we can have another conversation. We barely addressed all of the different concepts that you take up in your work, and I'd love to follow up with you again at some point. So thank you a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Nick, and I'm just really grateful for the work that you're doing to advance these kinds of conversations in your teaching and in your scholarship, and I will very much look forward to a follow-up conversation in the near future, and I hope that you and your family and your students and their families are staying very safe and healthy during this pandemic.
Thank you.